Blog Talk Radio.
Here we are this week. Overall crime in the nation is reported to be down. So is crime not committed in overalls. The crime reduction is probably due to the Arizona anti-immigration law. Okay, maybe not. Sales of existing homes shot up in April. That was expected due to it being the last month for the tax credit for home buyers, but the extent of the increase surprised everyone and is attributed to greater consumer confidence. Undoubtedly, you'll shortly hear the stimulus program had nothing to do with that. In California, high school students at a school near Palm Springs have apologized for playing a game after school called Beat the Jew. We'll have some more details about these sweet, sensitive kids in a few moments. A Senate panel has approved a bill that could end up changing Don't Ask, Don't Tell to Don't Bother Me, Leave Me Alone. Don't fall asleep on an airplane, we'll explain. A delegation of police chiefs have told the United States Attorney General Eric Holders that laws like Arizona's anti-immigration law could actually increase crime. West Hollywood, California, my former home, I might add, joins the group of cities that have banned the sale of dogs and cats in retail stores. If you're not in that business, this is great news. Housing sales are due to go up some more. The interest rate on a 30-year mortgage loan is down to 4.78%. Tomatoes may not be cheaper, but housing money is. This is usually a sign of a coming jolt to the housing market. Need another reason to not contribute to the International Red Cross? They have recently acknowledged that they've provided medical training to the members of the Taliban. Unlike Iraqis, against whom we went to war, though they had nothing to do with 9/11, the Taliban actually gave aid and comfort to Al-Qaeda and the murderers who crashed into the Twin Towers, the Pentagon, and the field in Pennsylvania, unless you believe Jesse Ventura. The International Committee of the Red Cross says this is consistent with their mandate, and they've also provided assistance to Hamas. Now, there's a great mark. The American Red Cross is also a Christian-centric organization antagonistic to religious and cultural pluralism. But I digress. Did I mention the Salvation Army? A research study in South Carolina has determined that heavier girls have a greater likelihood of having sex early, to have multiple partners during their teen years, and to use condoms less frequently than their thinner classmates. This is terrible news for parents whose daughters have put on some extra pounds. For high school boys, it's romantic advice. Mr. and Mrs. America and all the ships at sea, welcome to Speaking of Everything with Jeff Bushman. That would be moi. All that, news of the weird, and our guest, author, speaker, writers group president, publisher, business person. I've left something out, I know. She's going to talk to us about her books, her writing career, and the formation of her publishing company that now publishes other authors' books as well. But first, our book, The Mobile Millionaire, is available at mobilemillionaire, as if it were one word, .blogspot.com. The book, written by your humble servant, deals with investment in mobile homes as a way of gaining wealth and income, despite not having a great deal of money to make those investments. In fact, there is a chapter in the book that talks about how to get started with zero money. If you'd like to see the book and read an excerpt, that website again is mobilemillionaire.blogspot.com. If you were hearing a noise in the background as we were starting, that was our producer, Autumn Leaves Bushman, who was apparently protesting about not having her salary increased or something, or perhaps having her dog bed moved. I don't know, but it was one of those things. Let's go ahead and talk about some of these stories. In California, okay, here's what's been going on. This is, again, near Palm Springs. They've been chasing each other around in a game they call Beat the Jew. The story appeared in the Palm Springs Desert Sun. School officials and police say no hate crime was committed in this pursuit, which involves a runner called a Jew being chased by Nazis in cars. The students have apologized, according to the Desert Sands Unified School District Superintendent, Sharon McGee. They weren't disciplined because it happened after school and not on school property. She said they just played a game that had an ugly, insensitive, stupid name. Yeah. And an ugly, insensitive, stupid idea. Many of the students, all of whom participated willingly, said they played without knowing the name of the game. A town in that area, La Quinta, has a police department. Many cities do, of course. And the lieutenant, who is a spokesperson, Jason Husky, told the paper that because everyone played willingly, the game likely does not carry any kind of criminal implications. And officials learned about it, of course, when the kids reported it on their Facebook page. You have to ask yourself, you know, a long time ago, he's still around, but he's no longer in Congress. Congressman Dick Armey, a Republican from Texas, referred to Barney Frank, who is a congressman from Massachusetts and an openly gay member of Congress. He referred to him by the F word that is sometimes used with regard to gay men. And, pardon me, when it came out that he had said that, he apologized, and they asked Barney Frank how he felt about Dick Armey's apology, and he said, "I absolutely accept his apology. I believe he didn't mean to do that. The only thing I'd be concerned about is why it is he has that word roaming around in his brain." Similarly, you have to wonder where these kids get the idea. I mean, part of it, of course, is history, and knowing that Nazis in Germany and in other countries in Europe did, in fact, chase Jews. But they did it to kill them, to gas them and imprison them. And it just shows the great sensitivity these kids were taught by parents and teachers. It's a wonderful thing. The Senate panel, I believe it was the Senate Judiciary Committee, approved a bill for moving on to the Senate floor, which is designed to repeal the Don't Ask, Don't Tell law that was passed in 1993 when Bill Clinton was president. Clinton, as Commander-in-Chief of the Army, issued an executive order allowing the gay men and lesbians to serve in the military as long as they didn't reveal homosexual activity, and the military chiefs, the military officers, were no longer allowed to inquire into someone's sexual orientation. And that was actually a liberalization of sorts at the time. Thereafter, more or less immediately, Congress passed the law that followed the executive order, but by so doing, they created a situation where, in order to eliminate any restrictions on gay men and women serving in the military, there has to be a congressional act. And that is finally what seems to be moving towards passage. I don't know if that will be subject to a filibuster in the Senate, obviously, but it appears not, and I don't know why. I'm glad to see that it won't be, but I would have expected the Republicans in the Senate to at least threaten a filibuster. On the other hand, there are enough Republican senators and members of the House that have been implicated in secretive gay sex that perhaps possibility of a filibuster is reduced for that reason alone. We mentioned that it might be dangerous to fall asleep on an airplane. A woman in Michigan, she landed in Michigan, and fell asleep on an airplane before it landed. So she was asleep when it landed, and she was not awakened when the crew left the plane. She woke up, of course, after that and was unable to get off the plane, because there was nobody there to let her off, and clearly she didn't have access to the airplane's radio. And I was going to say, I assume she didn't want to turn on her cell phone because she would be violating some rule, but she may not have had one, obviously. And finally, about 4 hours later, a cleaning crew came aboard, and she was escorted off the plane. She was also interrogated as to why, what she was doing on the plane, not being allowed to be there when the plane was just sitting there. In any event, she's now suing. Interestingly, she's represented by a lawyer by the name of Jeff Feiger. Feiger, in the past, has run for governor of Michigan unsuccessfully, and he also previously represented Jack Kevorkian. I don't know if he still does. Jack Kevorkian, as you may remember, was the doctor who attempted to assist, in fact, did assist in several suicides for terminally ill patients and then went to jail for it, unfortunately. The police chiefs who told Eric Holder that the Arizona anti-immigrant law or might more correctly be said to be the anti-Latino law. But laws like that in Arizona would actually increase crime for a variety of reasons. One of the things they said was that by spending the time to ask someone about whom there might be reasonable suspicion with regard to illegal immigration status, their resources would be misdirected. They wouldn't be able to go ahead and send police to another stop, another crime scene, because they were busy finishing up the inquiries with regard to immigration status. And I will say that that's certainly possible and is likely to occur to some degree, but you also have to understand that, and although I agree with Holder and Obama, who have both criticized Arizona's law, and one that's coming up in Texas, I believe, which is designed to duplicate it, that I agree with their viewpoint. But frankly, this is kind of political theater. The police chiefs who were invited to speak to the Attorney General had to have been pre-selected. Not to say that a majority of police chiefs don't feel the same way. I don't know if that's true or not. But they wouldn't have invited a group of police chiefs who were in favor of that law to come speak to the Attorney General. I can almost guarantee this is designed to establish a basis for bringing the federal lawsuit that many of us have been waiting for, to attempt to demonstrate that the law is in one form or another unconstitutional. And my best guess as to why it's unconstitutional, not that I'm an expert in constitutional law, but my best guess as to why it will be determined to be unconstitutional is because the Constitution clearly provides that governing immigration, borders, and so forth is a responsibility of the quote-unquote federal government, that is the central government in Washington, not a role for state governments. West Hollywood, California. This is an interesting story, not specifically about West Hollywood. They're just the latest ones who have done it. Their city council unanimously passed a law that bans the sale of dogs and cats in retail stores within the city of West Hollywood. Frankly, that's not a real big deal, because if you know that area... By the way, West Hollywood was the same city that Republican Chairman Michael Steele brought those young Republicans, the Eagles, to a club to watch simulated sex acts. But West Hollywood is a city that really is surrounded by Los Angeles. So it's there. It is, in fact, a separate municipality, but it's really part of the greater Los Angeles area, or the not-so-great Los Angeles area, depending on one's viewpoint. So the fact that they passed that law is really more of a case of not really limiting very much. In fact, you could just go right over the border to Los Angeles or slightly further away to Beverly Hills and buy your dog or cat if you're so inclined. But it does make a statement of sorts, and that is, along with other cities, they joined South Lake Tahoe, California, Albuquerque, New Mexico, several cities in Florida and others in New Mexico and Missouri in banning the retail sale of pets. And here's what's really behind that. When you buy a pet at a pet store, what happens is the pet store, of course, wanting to make a profit, as all businesses should and do, order or buy another dog, another pet to replace the one you bought, so they have all their animals in inventory so they can sell to the next person to come along. The problem with that is that breeders, many of whom, not all of whom obviously, but many of whom are unscrupulous, will produce as many dogs and cats as possible as long as there's a market for them. And this results in puppy mills and kitty, they call it something else, not kitty mills, but kitty mills for purpose of this discussion. And those animals, and particularly the animals who are siring the animals to be provided to the pet stores, all of them have to be puppies. It's even worse than the adoption process, where people don't adopt older children. People really don't buy older dogs. So these animals go into the pet stores very often because of the unscrupulous breeders. They have health problems. In many cases, they're maltreated in the process of giving birth to the cute little puppies that you see in the pet stores. And all of that ends up causing a far greater pet population, much of which we don't need, Many animals are abandoned. Many end up in shelters. Many end up euthanized. That's killed. I know most of you know what the word euthanized means, but the fact is they end up being gassed to death because there are too many dogs and cats produced for sale in pet stores. So the effect of all these cities banning pet sales within their borders in a retail location doesn't really do that much, but if they could make enforceable licensing laws and require as a condition of licensing that, for example, if you have a second animal, you must spay or neuter at least one of the animals in order for you to get a license on both. And in a similar context, in England, I am told that if you have a pit bull or a Rottweiler, and if it's not a Rottweiler, it's another breed, pit bull and one other breed, and I'm pretty sure it is Rottweiler, you can have those dogs in England, but they do have enforceable license laws, which they're very tough on. And the only way you can license a pit bull or a Rottweiler is if it's spayed or neutered. The reasoning being that in a generation or two of humans, there will be no more of those dogs in the UK because they're seen to be what they are, which is time bombs. That's a little opinion there. Well, it's a big opinion, but it's a little bit of opinion. We talked about the housing sales both being up substantially and the fact that interest rates are down. Interest rates are down for a lot of reasons, not least of which is fear. There's a good deal of fear still about the economy, so there's not a lot of money being borrowed. When money isn't borrowed, the price of borrowing it goes down. That's what's happened. A lot of what's happening in the housing market now in terms of reluctant buyers is because of the fact that for a long time, even recently, banks weren't making loans. Now there are no customers there to make loans too. By the way, I should have given out the number to call in should you be inclined to do so, either now or after Joe joins us. The number is 347-994-3796. And she'll be joining us in about 7 minutes, so if you prefer to wait for that, that's fine. And we're going to go ahead and talk more about the Red Cross and the Salvation Army if we don't have a call. Let that be a warning to all of you. But the first thing I wanted to share with you is some news of the weird. We go to a website, newsoftheweird.blogspot.com, and I recommend it to you. There's also just newsoftheweird.com. They produce on both websites, and they do link to each other. But here is some of that. They have some really odd videotapes on the newsoftheweird.com, but they also usually share interesting news, and here are a couple of items. The fellow who runs the service LifeLock and flouted his own Social Security number to sell the LifeLock Identity Protection Service, you may remember hearing this commercial. My name is whatever his name is, which I don't recall, and my Social Security number is, and he reads it aloud, and he says, "That's my real Social Security number, but I feel comfortable giving it out because I use LifeLock." It turned out that since he's been doing this, he's had his identity stolen at least 13 times. In spite of that, in spite of the fact that reached the news recently, customers are still buying in at $10 to $15 a month. This next story is a little gross, so I wanted to warn you, if you are reluctant to hear a gross story, you might want to turn away for a second, or if you're listening in archives, speed it up a little bit. A school bus driver in Milwaukee was recently fired for, I'm trying to be delicate here, for routinely relieving herself in the number two way into plastic bags, which she would then toss out at her earliest convenience. This is in the event you needed another reason not to drive behind a school bus. Not a good idea. Finally, in that area of news, Lawrenceville, Georgia is trying to balance its 2010 budget. Like a lot of cities, it's having a lot of trouble. In order to do that, the town is going to try to get back bonuses it mistakenly paid to city workers in 1994. Good luck, folks. I think there was another story out of, this is also out of Milwaukee, and Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I mentioned that because there's also a Milwaukee, Oregon, and there's probably a Milwaukee somewhere near where some of you are listening. But John Chianelli as of last week, was sticking with a program he had introduced. The program, well, first off, he's the chief mental health officer of Milwaukee County, Wisconsin, and he started housing male and female inmates together in the same residential unit, because what this does, you see, is it reduces male-on-male violence. Okay. Maybe we need to talk again about the excess weight of the females in high school. Okay, the other story. Oh, the other story I wanted to talk about until Joe joins us in 4 minutes, and again, unless one of you wishes to call first, I'll try to be brief. Excuse me. The American Red Cross. I mentioned at the front that I describe them as a Christian-centric organization, antagonistic to pluralism in the United States. Now, that's not the same organization as the International Committee of the Red Cross, although they are affiliated. But the American Red Cross, every year in December, never wishes anybody who's not a Christian a happy holiday. They typically do not say happy holidays. I haven't watched television in a while, so I don't know if they did this last December, but for years. They show the cross, and they wish everybody a Merry Christmas. Whether you're Jewish, Muslim, Shinto, agnostic, atheist, doesn't matter. They want to wish you a Merry Christmas. Thank you, folks. We talked last, as we were approaching December 25th last year, on this show about the war on Christmas that the conservatives were complaining about. I'm joining it. If it is warlike on Christmas to say, I don't need to be wished Merry Christmas every time I'm coming in and out of a store, then I'm part of that war, because I don't really need to share someone's religion, or anyone's religion. Please, exercise as much religion as you'd like. Just leave me out of it. Thank you very much. That was the thing with the American Red Cross. Now, the Salvation Army, from what I understand, and if I'm wrong and someone wishes to correct me, feel free, but I've been saying this for a long time, no one has ever corrected me, so I'm assuming it's the truth. If you want help at the Salvation Army, they'll give it to you. They will. If you are down on your luck and you need help, and go to the Salvation Army, they'll provide you with some help. But first, you have to sit through a religious service during which they're going to try to get you to accept their brand of Christianity. Now, if you want to go to a church, that's fine. If you want to, if you're poor and you want to go to a church, fine. If you're poor or not and you want to accept the message of the Salvation Army, that's likewise fine. But do you really want to contribute to an organization that requires someone to accept the Salvation Army's religious views in order to get help? Okay. That's the end of the soapbox portion of the show. I wanted to invite you to call in, should you wish to, at 347-994-3796. In upcoming weeks, so you'll know, today is the 27th. On the 3rd, we have, believe it or not, I can't read my writing, so I can't tell you who the guest is next week. We have a number of guests. Larry Hancock, I will tell you, will be rejoining us on June the 10th. And we have a number of guests, many of whom are writers, most of whom are writers, because that seems to gain a very good response. Writers generally, and Larry Hancock in particular, seem to be audience favorites with you, and I'm glad of that. I also want to thank those of you who have joined us recently for rejoining us tonight. Please tell your friends, or if you don't like the show, any of your enemies or adversaries. Tell them what a wonderful thing it is, and then they'll be listening and they'll not like it and they won't blame you. That's basically what the show is. If you are listening to us live, we are also available in Archive Edition, the same place you came to hear this show, assuming you came to blogtalkradio.com/Jeff-Bushman, is also a place to hear the show, in Archive, and specifically you can get all the shows we've done. And we've been doing this for months and months. We've been doing this, I haven't looked, but it's got to be almost a year. And you can hear any of our old shows, although I would recommend to you not listen to the first few, because however lousy we are today, those were worse. And in any event, that's available to you. And if you are listening in Archive Edition, let me invite you to listen to the show live. We normally are on, not normally, we are in fact on live, at least during this part of the year, from 7:30 to 8:30 Pacific time. Oddly, because of the weird way that Arizona functions with time, and space for that matter, during the part of the year when the rest of the world does not follow daylight saving time. We never do. We're on at 6:30 Pacific, beginning at 6:30 p.m. Pacific, but I don't want to go into that now because it'll just confuse you as much as it confuses me. But for now and into the foreseeable future, until the time changes again, it's 7:30 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. Pacific. And during the live show, of course, you can call in, ask questions, pose arguments, talk about anything pretty much that you want to. And we will, of course, be happy to accommodate your call and speak with you. A couple of weeks ago, I don't remember how long ago, it must be about 4 weeks ago, we had a very good caller who was on with us for most of the show. We try not to limit callers on time unless they're saying things that are almost completely idiotic. That's my job. So if you'd like to join us, as I say, the number is 347-994-3796. If you're a writer who would like to ask questions regarding your writing and publishing, that opportunity is going to be available to you in about a second, because we're going to have joining us Jo Wilkins. I'm going to go ahead and introduce her. She's the Chief Executive Officer for Mystic Publishers, a company that helps qualified writers to bring their work to the public by self-publishing. And she also runs a traditional publishing house. And she's a teacher, an author, a poet, a president of a writers group in Nevada, and she joins us now. Jo, are you there?
I am.
I have this recurring nightmare that I'm going to go through an introduction of someone who I hook into the program, and I'm going to say, "And are you there?" And there's going to be complete silence. I just know it's going to happen. It's just a question of when. How are you?
I'm doing fine. How are you tonight?
Very well. Thank you, and thank you for joining us. Joe, you are, of course, a writer, and I realize I'm not telling you this, I'm telling our audience, but you originally did some self-publishing of your book, and then you created an actual formal publishing house. Tell us about your book and the self-publishing process and how it is you decided to become a publisher and what's occurred since.
You've got 30 seconds. Oh, wow. Actually, we decided to self-publish right off the bat. We never actually put our books out there. We have three in a five-book series, and I write this series with a gentleman down in Tempe, Richard Droughty.
Mm-hmm.
Also, he I lost my train of thought there. We went through, and we had a really bad experience. We worked with a company for about a year, and what we got between the covers was not what we signed off on. And we figured there had to be something out there for people who wanted to self-publish where they could get it economically and, dealing with a company with a lot of integrity. And that's what
right.
we strive to do with Mystic Publishers, is help people where they need to be helped. A lot of our customers have their own imprint, and we just do their back room work for them.
Well, I want to go into that in a minute, but first let's talk about the books. You've published
uh-huh.
three books. The plan is to do five, right?
Yes. They're science fiction.
And,
okay. Go ahead.
Give us the. I was just going to say, it's the you refer to it as the Tyranny series.
Uh-huh.
Tell us the titles and basically what the series is designed to do.
It's Tyranny's Outpost, Tyranny's Prisoner, Tyranny's Alliance are the ones that are done right now. We're working
uh-huh.
on Tyranny's Shadow.
Okay.
And this will actually end the series, and then we're going back to the prequel.
Mm-hmm.
In our story, 300 years before our first story starts, a group of travelers left the Earth. They were the first ones to use hyperspace. They were the first
mm-hmm.
ones out there. They went way far out, and society just caught up with them.
Mm-hmm.
And they are being oppressed by basically a pirate, we call her a privateer, and
right.
her group, and they don't know that the rest of the human race is out there except for these few people they've seen. And they basically, our travelers, our main characters, help them to secure their freedom there and get their world back in with the colonies of Earth. And that's the first one.
Okay. And is that the one you had been working with a company that was designed
mm-hmm.
to self-publish, and that didn't work out, so you then did it again yourselves?
Yes.
Is that right? Okay.
I learned a whole lot that first year.
Go ahead with what you're going to say about. Yeah.
I knew a lot about writing, but I didn't know diddly squat about publishing. So
publishing.
You know, it was.
Well,
yeah.
it's a wholly different skill set, obviously.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely, and since that was in 1903, and since then
you meant. You meant 2003. You said 1903.
Yes, I'm sorry. That's 2003. 1903 was when my piano was made.
See, there you are.
It's an antique. So, see, I wasn't too far off on something.
Well, there you go.
My Freudian.
So, there you go. Then you wrote the second book, you and mm-hmm. Richard. Is it Richard?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you and Richard wrote Tyranny's Prisoner,
mm-hmm.
and that carries the story forward, obviously.
Yes, it does. One of the characters in the first book is kidnapped at the end of the first book, and in the second book it's the search for him and the reasons why he's important to the colonies of Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And
pretty
it
good.
Turns out pretty good at the end. I mean, it has to, you know. It's
sure.
part of, it's the middle section of a series.
That's right.
But, yeah, and then in Tyranny's Alliance, there's there's a time frame where there's a lapse of time, and we have this planet that's been in the first two that is called the what they refer to as the gangster planet, because it was corrupted, and someone comes in and completely cleans it up and makes it a viable place for people to do commerce with, and then they find out that our main bad guy, who's a woman. She is behind it all, and it's destroying that myth. So they're all different. They're all standalone stories.
Right. I was going to ask you, you could read any of these by themselves, correct? You wouldn't
mm-hmm.
necessarily have to read the first one to read the second one and enjoy it.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, let's go back to the publishing portion of what you were talking about, and I want to
mm-hmm.
talk about your experience with the writers group as well.
Okay.
I have some serious doubt we can cover everything we want to cover by the time we leave the air tonight, but let's go ahead and try that. The publishing experience, so what? Again, I understand you learned a bunch of things, but when you went into actual publishing for yourself, what did you do? How did you? And the reason I'm asking this question is because there are a lot of our listeners who are writers or would-be writers, who have heard about self-publishing, don't really know what's involved, probably would love to know more, but haven't, you know, gone ahead and done a lot of research on it yet. So
right.
go ahead and give us a clue as to what that involved.
Basically, you have to find you have to get with printers, you have to find out what programs they will accept, because if you do it in Word or Publisher
mm-hmm.
or anything like that and send it to a printer, they're going to send it right back to you. Because they're not
okay.
equipped to handle those programs. You have to right now it's like InDesign or Quark or there's one other I can never remember the name of. Anyway, but you use specific programs, you save it in a specific way, and then those go to the printer so that nothing changes when it's printed.
Yeah, those are basically desktop publishing programs you're referring to.
Right. No, they're more extensive than that. Like we use InDesign
okay.
from Adobe.
Right.
Quark is an extremely expensive program.
Right.
And then the other one that I can never remember is kind of in
right.
between both of them.
Okay, I was under the impression Quark. I had not really heard of InDesign, but I was under the impression that Quark was a desktop publishing program. But obviously, you're letting me know.
Well, it is and it isn't. I mean, it's a very refined program and
mm-hmm.
quite expensive. Most, you know, and you have to be really technical in order to use it, is
okay.
what I've heard. I have never seen it. Right.
Okay, no, I understand. So InDesign you use, and basically what you do is you take your text and feed it into the program.
Yeah, we make a template
mm-hmm.
the size we want the book to turn out. And then we drop it in. We do it by chapters. We you know you have to make sure the formatter's all there. You have to make sure that there's the correct amount of pages for the printer, Because some of them work on a set of four, some 16, some 32. It depends on if you're doing
what kind of
digital
press they
printing.
Have.
Well, digital or offset, yeah.
Right. And so you
and
go
then
ahead
you have
and do
to
that,
coordinate
you create
with the,
your book.
Yeah, and then you have to coordinate with the graphic artist to who does the cover. And and they have to do the spine according to how much, you know, how many pages are in your book, and it's an involved process. And they have
now,
templates
what,
they
what
work
you
off
just,
of.
What you, just, what you just said a lot of people are not going to understand. Let me see if I understood you, because I'm not sure
okay.
I do. You said that the work on the spine is dependent on the number of pages in your book. In other
yes.
words, if you have a larger book, you have a larger spine. The spine is the space
mm-hmm.
between the back and the front cover, the portion of the cover that goes down the spine of the book, correct?
Yes, and we have a calculator that we use where we plug in the amount of pages and the type of paper we're going to use for the printer, and then that gives us the spine size, and we give that to the graphic artist that's working with our author.
Yeah, and the kind of paper you're using is important because different papers have different thicknesses, which means that the dimensions of the book
mm-hmm.
are going to be different relative to the spine, right?
Yeah, and you want to be sure you want to use a paper that doesn't bleed through because
right.
you don't want to be able to see the writing from the opposite page or pictures
yeah.
if there's pictures in there.
That can be a little distracting.
Yeah.
Okay.
Very much so.
Now, yeah. Now, you've been doing this on your own books, but I understand you have also created a situation where you're publishing other people's books, although not a lot of them yet. Do I understand that correctly?
Well, we've done 72 books.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
So these books, I misunderstood. Are you the official publisher, or are you just printing for people who are self-publishing?
We some of them come in with their own imprint, and others
uh-huh.
come in and they're only going to do one or two books, and they don't want to buy a block of ISBN numbers, so they use some of ours, and it goes out under the Mystic Publishers label, and those we have done 72 books.
Wow, that's a bunch.
Yeah.
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 But now, do you actually do the promotion, or is that really left to the author and
we
and that
we
sort of
help
thing?
With the promotion because we're authors too, so we kind of band together and do promotional activities. You know, if I'm invited to go to a conference, I usually
right.
ask them if I can get a vendor table, and then I either bring some of my authors or some of their books with them so they can sit at the table and do signings.
That's great.
You know, I mean, we do things at the county fair. We've done book signings at Borders and Barnes & Nobles here locally.
Really?
And we do them as a group. We either do them under the Mystic Publishers, you know, persona, or we do them under Henderson Writers Group.
Okay, before we get to the writers group, let me ask you another question, because a lot of people who have been involved in self-publishing will say, you can do a bunch of stuff, and sometimes you can get into independent bookstores, but you'll never see a Barnes & Noble, for example. And
not
you cross that threshold.
Not necessarily, because the thing with a self-published book is, if you publish through a vanity press, they always mark
right.
it when they list it with Boker, which is who you have to list
mm-hmm.
the ISBNs with. When they list it there, they don't go in and check that the book is returnable. Because
okay.
they don't want to take returns. And
right.
if a book is not returnable, a bookstore is not going to take it.
Okay, you need to explain that a little better. What happens in
okay.
the normal course when it is returnable? Because a lot of people
okay,
aren't
in the
understand.
Normal course when it's returnable, they have 90 to 120 days, the bookstore does, to hold on to the book. After that period of time, whatever in their contract, they can send the book back to you for a refund.
For a refund, okay.
Yes. And that's why I always tell my authors, you know, for at least 6 months, hold on to that money, because those bookstores could come back to you and say, we
right.
can't sell your book. Here's, you know, five of them back
right.
after they've taken 20, you know, or
uh-huh.
they can return all six that they took in the first place.
Sure. So when the book is returned and the author or the self-published author pays back the money, then, of course, the author has that book and can go ahead and try again to sell it. But irrespective of that, if you don't make it returnable, they won't take it in the first place because then they're left with any remainder books.
That's right. The only stipulation we make is we will not take back damaged books.
Sure.
And where we're listed with Baker and Taylor, which is, you know, a national distributor, we've got that stipulation in the contract there. We will not take back damaged merchandise, because then the author can't resell it.
Right.
Yeah.
So when the author comes to you guys, you actually where you print it under your company's imprint,
mm-hmm.
then it is through you and it goes out to the distributors and so on. So that's not something
mm-hmm.
they have to do a lot of.
Right.
And
then basically
you
orders come through me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, the orders come through me, and then I go to the author and I say, I need 5 books for Baker and Taylor. And then they give me those books plus the shipping that it's going to take to send it.
Right.
And that way I don't have to pay their shipping.
Sure, sure.
Because it gets expensive.
Right, of course it would. And then of course, they make the money minus your guys' cut for the books that sell.
Well, we don't really take a cut for their books.
Oh, okay. I understand.
I charge them $1 for the paperwork and
mm-hmm.
the shipping, and the rest of it is theirs.
That's terrific.
Because,
That's great.
Most of the time, they're only sending paperwork through me to the author.
Right.
But I've got one author here that borders orders from me probably twice a year because she's doing book signings. And they'll order 25, 30 books. You know, and they go directly to me.
Yeah.
They don't even go through Baker and Taylor. And then I just call her up and say, hey, I got an order for 25 books.
Yeah,
so.
And she says, I'm on my way.
Yeah.
Okay,
well, you know,
great.
And in her case, I just tell her, either deliver them to the store or mail them back in, you know, and that way
mm-hmm.
she's covering her shipping.
Right. Yeah, if it's something local.
And then
local,
when I get the check, I cut it out
period.
To her, and she's got it.
Because
they pay it through me.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's one author helping another, as well as helping
too.
People who want to self-publish.
Sure. Sure, absolutely. When someone does want to self-publish, typically it costs them, from what I've heard, at least until recently. First off, until recently it was prohibitive. But now it's still going to cost you a bunch of money. And I guess the question is, how many authors make their money back, first, generally? And secondly, would someone in your experience, do you usually have a higher percentage of folks who make their money back when they deal with you?
Well, most of the time we try to counsel people. If they have a book that's going to sell, whether or not they have a book that's going to sell, we try
mm-hmm.
to tell them, if you've got a memoir and you're not a
famous
person or infamous person, you're probably not going to sell the memoir. I don't care who you are, or people don't recognize your name, they're not going to buy your book.
They can't, because they don't know who you are. They're not really going to care about what happened in your life, unfortunately.
Right. You know, but I mean, there's a fellow here in town. And I'm not going to plug his book because I'm not sure he wants anybody to know. But he had a killer marketing plan, and his was a murder mystery. He hid an item here in town, and all the clues are in the book. I mean, he's on his third or fourth printing, and he's doing 5,000 books at a time.
Wow.
Or 1,000 books at a time. I'm sorry.
Either way, that's
you know. I mean, and it's unheard of for a self-published
right.
author to do this. He's doing his second book. We're formatting it right now. You know, and but he knows about marketing. He knows what he needed to do, and he developed this plan and started getting it out there before the book came out. And
right.
And
so
you know, that's what we tried. Yeah, that's what we try to tell everybody. You need to get your platform established before you even bring the book to us.
Hmm.
Because it takes 3 to 6 months, maybe, to get the book out. And you want to stimulate that interest. You want to have a website. You want to be posting pre-publication reviews. You want to put maybe a chapter, you know, or a blurb at least from the book up there for people
sure.
to read.
Yeah.
Start a blog. Talk about the process of writing. You know, talk about the story. All kinds of things like that. We
and
give
let,
them advice
let
because,
know.
Yeah, we don't want to take anybody's money and have them mm-hmm. come back to us and say, but my book's not selling and you did this and you told me that and you promised me the world, because we don't want to do that, you know.
Sure. Absolutely.
And,
okay.
And being
well,
authors...
Go ahead. Mm-hmm.
You know, I was going to say, being authors, it's like a natural progression. We wouldn't want somebody telling us our book is going to sell when it won't.
Well, that's something like the experience you had, was it not, in the first instance?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's kind of like, you know, if someone's involved in a relationship and they're treated badly in a particular way, they usually will make sure that they don't treat anybody that way in the future.
That's right.
A similar situation. You are the president of the Henderson Writers Group, if
yes,
I got the
sir.
Name right. Okay.
Uh-huh.
And tell us what... Well, first off, tell us about writers' groups generally, because a lot of people, well, I guess most people know what those are. It's writers coming together in a group. But
yeah.
But what do you do in your group in Henderson? By the way, for those who don't know, Henderson is essentially right next to Las Vegas.
Yes.
Okay.
We're actually bigger than Las Vegas. But, in the year 2001, I put an ad in the paper because I couldn't find a writers' group. And I got some writers together. We had 32 people in our first meeting.
Wow.
And our second meeting, we had 8. And we stayed at 8 for about a year, year and a half. And at this point in time, we cover the whole entire valley. And with, you know, members across the whole entire valley of Clark County, Las Vegas Valley.
Right.
And we have almost 100 members.
Wow.
We have
and the 100 members attend pretty regularly?
We have a meeting every week, so average 25 to 30 members at a meeting, and
that's
we're
fun.
Primarily a critiquing group. People sign up to read. They read for 10 minutes. They have 5 minutes of critiquing. We get in 5 to 8, depending on our location. We get in 5 to 8 readers at each meeting. We also have an online group that we actually have members, you know, from out of the state.
Sure.
That join the online group where they post parts of their manuscript or chapters, and it's a closed group, so nobody outside the group can get in.
Right.
They're critiqued by other members.
That's
and
great.
We have members. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say we have members all the way from those who are just barely starting out up to the other members like me who are multi-published.
Right. The question I was going to ask you is if there is a writer in the audience who wants to find out more about that group and the possibility of joining it, the online group, how would they go about doing that?
They would go to www.hendersonwritersgroup.com.
Okay, and no apostrophes, folks.
No,
just
no
hendersonwritersgroup.com.
Uh-huh.
And speaking of the web, well, first off, you have a writers' conference that goes on in Las Vegas, too, correct?
We have a writers' conference every April.
Okay. Obviously that's recently passed because today is, we're about the end of May. But for folks who want to find out about that, the website would be LasVegasWritersConference.com.
Yes.
And they can find out about that and make their plans for the next spring traveling season.
Mm-hmm. We're putting together our faculty right now for next year.
Mm-hmm. Was there anybody well known in terms of writing who was on your faculty last year?
Let's see. We had Brandy Bowles. She's an agent out of New York. We had Bob Mayer, who is a well known author and writing. I'm not sure if he teaches writing or if he's a writer's coach.
Okay.
Last year we had Patrick Labruto from Tor Books. I'm trying to remember off the top of my head. Next year we're hoping to have Eva Shaw back. She's a phenomenal speaker. We had Judy Morio, who's a national speaker. She's on the national speaking circuit about building platforms and you know, promoting yourself. We try to have at least 6 to 8 agents and publishers there. Plus, we also have specialists in different areas like editors and marketing and all of that. I mean, we even held a class this year on what's the difference between self-publishing and mainstream publishing.
Oh, mainstream. Okay.
Yeah.
And let me also touch upon the fact that your book's availability in the Tyranny series, I assume those are available through Amazon and Borders and Barnes & Noble.
They
and
are. They're available through Amazon.com and Barnes & Noble online, and they're here locally in a few stores.
Okay. Well, but since not that many people are in the Las Vegas area compared to those who could listen
and
on the web, I want to make sure.
And they can be through the Mystic Publishers site.
Which is the next question I was going to ask you. Why don't you give us the Mystic Publishers website?
It's www.mysticpublishers.com. Mm-hmm.
Yes, and for those who don't know, that's Mystic, M-Y-S-T-I-C,
oh, yes.
Publishers. Okay. Well, you know, you just have to make sure. I happen to be married to someone who is brilliant, and I guarantee you she could spell Mystic because she's into that sort of thing. But she's brilliant, but her spelling generally is not top-notch. So you can be extremely smart and not be a good speller.
We all rely on spell check.
Well, yeah, although I will tell you, in all honesty, I'm not necessarily that brilliant, but I am a very good speller, but I do make typos. Spell check is my saving grace for that reason.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And we've just purchased our first book to publish through our new entity, Joe Reed Publications. So,
well, that's great. Now, let me ask you a question.
That.
Yeah, you should be. Now, you're talking then in that context about being the more formal, traditional type of publisher. You're branching out,
yes.
Obviously.
Yes.
And
that was our goal in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
We actually wanted to put together Mystic Publishers and then go into traditional publishing to help first-time authors.
Okay. Now, we probably need to explain. For regular traditional publishing involves, I mean, it seems strange to have to explain this, but you know, especially in the modern world, where there is a great deal of self-publishing now,
mm-hmm.
the traditional publishing process is you write a book, or you propose to write a book, as the case may be, submit
mm-hmm.
it to a publisher. The publisher decides to publish it. The publisher, well, why don't you go ahead and explain the rest of the process? I'm not the expert here. You are.
Well, basically, the publisher incurs all of the costs of putting it out. They do the majority of the marketing, no matter who you are, no matter what author you are, you still are responsible for doing some marketing.
Right.
But the publisher sets up most of that. And mm-hmm. in this day and age, I mean, it's a lot less expensive than it could be, but it still runs a pretty penny. I mean, we can self-publish someone for $2,000 or under. And they'll have 150 books.
Well, that's great. That is very reasonable compared to what a lot of places
would
charge.
You know, but if, you know, there are cases where I had a lady that wrote a book and she had a built-in audience because her son was murdered. And she wrote a book about the experience of them searching for him.
Mm-hmm.
And so they do all kinds of speaking engagements through Nevada Child Seekers and you know, places like that. And so they have a lot of backroom sales. And she ordered 1,000 books to start with, you know.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it depends on who your audience is, what kind of marketing you're going to do. I always tell most of the people here that come to me, order 100 books or 150 books at the most, because
right.
you don't know if you're going to have an audience.
Right. And why go spend an enormous amount of money and not have anybody buy a book?
And then you have to store them all.
Yeah, that too. Well, at least, as you say, if you're starting out with 150 books, that may be annoying to have to store, but it's not like trying to store 4,000.
Yeah, but 150 books comes in 3 or 4 boxes.
Right.
You know, but, you know, I always tell my authors, when you get the first box of books, just stand over it, open it up, and just breathe in, because there's nothing like that. There's that smell.
The smell of your book.
That, you know, oh, yeah, it's your book, and this is what my book smells like. I mean, I told one lady, I says, it's better than having a baby. You're holding that baby for the first time.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's different.
And you don't have to change the diaper.
Right. That's one good thing about it.
Yeah, you know, you may not be aware of this, and I mentioned it as my self-promoting commercial at the beginning of the book. I have a book on the web about mobile home investment. And so this, we move from the general to the personal. One of the things that I've been trying to reason out for, you know, a long time is, other than that, you know, what kind of groups do you go if you're self-published? It doesn't have to be my book, but just generally. Let's say that I've published a book on, you know, how to build a computer mouse, okay, or something equally stupid. And, you know, how would a self-published author get a place to go speak in front of a group or do something so that she or he could, in fact, get the book bought?
Well, first of all, you have to find those places. Like if you wrote a book on something about computers, you go to all the computer stores in town and say, I've got this book. I want to do a book signing. You guys have people here that are coming in looking for information that I provide in my book. So could I set up a book signing here?
Right. So it doesn't have to be a bookstore. It can be a computer. It can be something which is similar product.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, and a lot of stores will love that. I mean, because it's extra draw. We did a group book signing out in front of Whole Foods one year.
Wow.
And they were really excited. We got to talk about the writers group. We got to talk about the Las Vegas Writers Conference. And we had authors there during the day at periodic times that brought their books in and sold their books, you know. And people really like to have a book that's signed by the author.
Oh yeah,
it makes it,
and just like to meet, just like to meet
special
authors, even if, and they like to meet authors even if they've never heard of them and are not familiar with the subject matter of books. Just the idea of, I met this author over here, and look, I've got this signed. But yeah, I mean, there is some level of prestige or equivalent 15 seconds of fame or something. Yeah, to
right.
Help with that.
Yeah, you know, it's fun. Speaking from the
inside. That's right. We've only got a few minutes left, Joe, and we didn't get a chance to talk about more of your writing, but I will go ahead and mention to our audience that you also teach writing for the City of Henderson, and you have taught classes at the Clark County Library, and you've also had essays on NPR, or your local NPR station in any event.
Yeah, KNPR.org.
Yeah, so you've really been very active in writing and teaching and mentoring. Any last words for aspiring authors or publishers?
Aspiring authors, I would say, make sure that your work is edited by someone in the field before you present it. Because if you get an editor that knows what's going on, and that knows what publishers are looking for, you're going to have a better product to present, and you're going to have a better chance of getting picked up.
Okay, good. One other thing, since we do have a minute or so left, well, almost two, actually. Let's assume that I'm not a writer, okay? I'm a reader with polyglot tastes, okay?
Okay.
We used to say Catholic tastes, but that, you know, we don't want to get religion involved. Okay. But with someone with taste like that, how would they go about finding books that are broadly, they're not available in, you know, by just necessarily walking into Barnes & Noble? There are a lot of self-published books out there. How would somebody go about it? I don't know the answer to that. It's one of those rare things where you ask a question when you don't know the answer. Go ahead.
There are websites that you can go to where authors list their books for sale. You can look at what was it? You can look on the search and put in self-published books. You can put in books for sale in the search, and a lot of times you'll come up with things like that. You can look at small publishers and see what books they have available just by finding their sites, and you can Google small publishers.
Okay, great. Listen, it's been great having you. We are essentially out of time. I just got the 60-second warning. Thank you. The main site where someone can access your information is mysticpublishers.com.
Yes.
Correct? Okay.
Yes.
We've been talking, of course, to Joe Wilkins. Thanks so much. It's been a pleasure talking to you. It's been very enjoyable.
Thank you.
I speak for anybody who's listening as well. All right. Thanks again. That's the website to get to Joe's stuff, and you can get her books there, as well as find out more about her programs and her self-publishing program as well. Thanks very much, Joe.
All righty.
Good night. Thanks. And thank all of you for listening and joining us. Hope you've enjoyed the show tonight at least as much as I have, and I have. Hope you join us next week, and when we'll have another guest and more talking about the news and talking about everything else. Thanks again. Have a great night. Good night.